Hey folks, so hope your winter and everything is going well, depending on where you are. But I wanted to share with you the conversation that I had at the Sound Education Conference back in November that took place at Harvard last year. It's supposed to be an annual conference, so it should take place this year too, at least I'm planning on it. And it was a ton of fun. It was really great meeting a lot of other podcasters I have a lot of respect for. It was just a lot of interesting conversation and thoughtful people and great presentations. So it was really a pleasure to go, and I wanted to share the talk that I gave there with you right here on my show. But I did run into a little bit of a problem. You see, I gave a presentation with a PowerPoint and everything, so I'm pointing at all these pictures, and it doesn't really translate very well if you just listen to it. So I thought I would kind of re-record it here, more meant for audio, and you can listen to it here. But also in the notes to this episode, if you just scroll down in your podcast player, there should be a link going to the video. So if you want to go and watch the actual talk I gave, you can do that there. It's on YouTube if you use the link. Otherwise, listen to it right here. I don't think it's terribly surprising to say that history is often viewed as something static, fixed, and because of that can often be seen as boring. It's something that's carved in stone, and we can look back on it and visit the past and enjoy the stories, but we can't change it, and it can't affect us. Today, I want to talk about what we miss when we view history that way, and although we will, of course, be talking about ancient Athens, I want to start today in kind of a strange place. I want to start today with a Bible story. So many of you are familiar with the story of Abraham and Isaac. And if you are, though, why I'm telling it to you, try to imagine that you're sitting here and you're listening to me tell you the story, but you're in a church back in the 1800s. It's a hot summer day. You don't really maybe want to be here anyway, and you've heard this story a dozen times before, and you could tell it yourself if you needed to. But the story of Abraham and Isaac is that Abraham, who lived way back in the day, and he lived during a time when it was very common to be sacrificing animals to God to appease for your sins. This is something we see pretty similar in a lot of different religions in the ancient world, sacrificing animals to atone for some type of wrongdoing towards a deity. And Abraham was no stranger to this. He had sacrificed quite a few animals in his day to make up for his own sins. But one day, God shows up to Abraham, and God says, "Abraham, you've been doing great. I really appreciated all these animals. But I need you to do something a little bit different for me now. You've been sacrificing animals, but now I need you to sacrifice your son, your one and only son, Isaac." And to Abraham, Isaac is not some, you know, third-tier backseat child that he kind of puts up with. Isaac is his pride and joy, and God has just asked him to sacrifice him. Now, as you're sitting there back in that church, the shock of this is probably completely lost on you since you've heard this story so many times. But Abraham, he gets together his wood, he takes Isaac, his son, and he goes on the 3-day journey to Mount Sinai, where he's going to sacrifice his son, Isaac. But Isaac is pretty sharp, and so as they're walking, Isaac starts to ask Abraham, "Father, where is the ram? You know, where's the sacrifice? What are we exactly going to kill? We've got the wood, we've got stuff to make the fire, we're going to build the altar when we get there, but what are we planning on sacrificing?" And Abraham just tells him that God will provide, and they keep walking along. And then after 3 days, they get to the site where this sacrifice is going to be performed. And Abraham takes his one and only son, Isaac, and ties up his hands and ties up his feet and puts him in the altar. And right as Abraham is about to strike Isaac and kill him, God stops him, just in time. He says, "Congratulations, Abraham, you have passed this test. Look up, there's a ram conveniently located in a thicket next to you. Go take that and sacrifice it instead." Now, on the surface of it, this seems like a happy story, right? God tested Abraham, but Abraham was able to pass this test with flying colors. Isaac, thankfully, did not actually have to be sacrificed, and Abraham still got to sacrifice a ram to God. Everybody wins, right? And this is probably the attitude you would have had back in that church in the 1800s on that hot summer day, as you've heard this story for now the 13th time. But as you're nodding along, agreeing, yes, Abraham has great faith, he's passed the test, this all works out very well, we get the moral of the story, there was a man also in that church named Soren Kierkegaard. And Kierkegaard, he was a philosopher in the 1800s, and what he wanted us to realize was how insane the story is if you're living in it. While everybody is just nodding along to the story, Soren Kierkegaard says, hold up. Abraham is being asked to take his one and only son, his child, slit his throat, and light him on fire. And everybody is just okay with that? This is crazy. Now, Kierkegaard was not trying to dismantle Christianity. In fact, he was actually a Christian himself, but he just wanted to take a closer look at what faith actually meant. Kierkegaard has this quote. He says that if Abraham went into this somehow knowing the ending of the story, then, quote, then let's forget him. For why bother remembering a past that cannot be made into the present? End quote. And that is the reason that I just told you a Bible story. For why bother remembering a past that cannot be made into the present? In other words, if you are reading the story of Abraham and you forget about the fear that he had that he might have to kill his son and the love that he had for his son, you lose the point of the story. If you are looking at the end of the Athenian Empire as the Athenians are watching their empire collapse around him, and you cannot remember the fear that they have that these people hate them and might just want to kill them horribly, then you forget why they take the actions they do. This is what Kierkegaard means when he says that we need to take the past and bring it into the present. It should be felt just as if we are experiencing it ourselves. And now we can go to ancient Athens. So, a little bit of background here. This is not necessarily a war story, but it does take place during a war, so it's important to know the background here. Though if you're listening to the show and have been the entire time, I imagine you're probably at least, I hope, you're passingly familiar with the Athenian history and what we're about to go through. But just a quick summary for a minute here. Basically, Persia wanted to come over and attack Greece. A giant alliance was formed between a lot of the Greek cities to fight against Persia. But then after Persia was kicked out, Athens took control of this, made it into an empire. People didn't like this very much. A lot of people in this empire were complaining that Athens had done this. So they started complaining to Sparta. Sparta, after getting a lot of complaints, because they're kind of slow movers, decided to go and fight Athens. And so that's essentially the story. It took me 2 years to tell in a podcast summarized into about 20 seconds. But the point of the war that we are concerned with is the Battle of Pylos. Quick refresher on Pylos, because it was, it was probably a year and a half ago that we actually covered it. But quick refresher on Pylos. Athens had managed to build this fort in Spartan territory. Sparta obviously wasn't very happy about this. Staged some troops on a nearby island to go attack it, but then Athens sent its navy and surrounded that island. So you have some Spartan troops on this island that it's surrounded by an Athenian navy. Seems extremely advantageous for Athens. They're going to be able to capture all these really elite Spartan troops that are on this island. But food is being smuggled out to the Spartans on this island by their slaves, and these slaves are so good at it that it's not the Spartans on the island that start to starve to death, but instead it's the Athenian navy that starts to run out of supplies. This is a deeply ironic and embarrassing situation for the Athenian military. So back home in Athens, the Athenian citizens are furious with their generals. Particularly, they're taking it out on a man named Nicias. Nicias is one of the generals in charge of this force. And they're yelling at Nicias, how could you let this happen? We had such a good advantage and you're starting to blow it. And one of the people that's leading the charge against Nicias is a man named Cleon. Now, we don't need Cleon's full background, but we do need to know what his policies are. What would he like to do? You see, in the past, when rebellions have happened against Athens, his suggestions have been to go in and wipe out entire cities, kill all the men, take all the women and children and sell them into slavery, basically take the city off the map and turn it into Athenian territory. Now, at this point, this has not yet been done. Cleon is not really even much of a politician, not a general at all. But he is leading the charge. He's loud, he's leading the assembly and yelling at Nicias. And so the scene that we have here is Nicias, the general, who's in charge of this embarrassing situation at Pylos, and then Cleon, who's leading the charge with the assembly, and they're yelling at each other. Now, Cleon is looking at Nicias and saying, you know, if we actually had men for generals, this would have been taken care of already. Nicias is sick of Cleon, and so instead of really kind of going toe-to-toe with him, he says, listen, do you think you can do a better job? And the assembly starts teasing Cleon because they see he's backing down. He's a little embarrassed. But Cleon, he's not one to really back down all the way. And so when Nicias says, do you think you can do a better job? Cleon says, yeah, give me control of the military. I can go over there and get this done for you. And the Athenian assembly, they're kind of okay with this. Some of them just simply think it's funny that Cleon is going to maybe take control of the military on a dare. Others are actually sick of Nicias leading this military and so do want Cleon to replace him. And others don't really care that much. They just kind of get a kick out of the situation. So on a dare, Cleon is put in charge of the Athenian military. And we don't need to get into the details of it, but Cleon actually pulls this off. He goes over to Pylos, this island where the Spartans are stuck, manages to capture all of them, or kill the rest that he doesn't capture, and bring them all back to Athens. He takes their shields, actually, that they're never supposed to surrender, and hangs their shields up around Athens as trophies, saying, look at what I've done. So Cleon was just some guy in the assembly with a big mouth that got elected to be general on a dare. But what do you think happens after he pulls this off at Pylos? Obviously, his stock goes up. People's opinion of him rise in the city. And so these ideas that he's had in the past about the fact that cities should be wiped out when they rebel, maybe that's not such a crazy idea. Maybe if Cleon can do something so bold and daring as taking the men on this island and capturing them and bringing them to Athens, maybe his other ideas aren't too bad either. Cleon actually dies not too long after this, but as cities in the Athenian Empire continue to rebel, and Athens is running increasingly short on patience and resources, Cleon's ideas are put into practice. To Athens' credit, this only happens a couple times, but entire cities have their male populations killed, and the women and children sold into slavery, and the culture of these cities are wiped out. And you can trace it all the way back to the time in the Athenian assembly where somebody shouted out to Cleon and Nicias, I double dog dare you. History is alive and living and pulsing, partially because we do not know the impact of our own actions. Now, the final story I want to tell you before we start tying everything together here is about a man named Pericles. Pericles, even if you have not listened to the rest of this show, you are probably familiar with Pericles if you know anything about ancient Athens. Essentially, he was the premier man in Athens for over 20 years. He helped create the city that we think of when we think of Athens, the culture, the riches. But at the beginning of this Peloponnesian War, when Sparta and Athens have fought each other, the first year of war has elapsed, and it is time to honor the people that have died in it. This is something that Athens does, is after the first year of war, they have this big public funeral, and somebody is asked to give a speech honoring the men that have died in this first year of war. They ask Pericles. Now, Pericles, he gives this speech, and if you think about it like this, actually, Pericles is essentially asked to look back on the past year and summarize it, and in about 20 minutes or so, present it to an audience. In short, Pericles is asked to give a little history podcast on these men and honor them. And so what he does instead is a little bit surprising. When Pericles starts out his speech, he talks about not the men, but Athens and how great it is. How its system, its city is unparalleled in any of the Greek cities, that it is an example to the world around it. He says that it is the best system and stands far beyond anything else that Greece can present. And then finally, maybe about halfway into the speech, pivots to talk about these men. The reason he talked about the city so much is that it's what drove these men. It's what inspired these men was their creation of such a city. You see, the things that we have been talking about today, the way that people don't know the outcome of their own story and it creates a fear and uncertainty that drives many of their actions, I think Pericles understood this. And he also understood that what we are doing right now, be it intentional or not, will one day be history. In other words, we are both living in and causing the aftershocks of history. Towards the end of his funeral oration, as it's known, his speech that he gives in the situation, that we can really see all these themes tie together. This is, I think, the way that we should view history. Acknowledge the fear, look forward into our future, but know that we can't necessarily know the outcome. Listen to this last paragraph of Pericles' speech. And he's talking about these men that have died for the city. Quote, "So and such, they were these men, worthy of their city. We who remain behind may hope to be spared their fate, but must resolve to keep the same daring spirit against the foe. I could tell you a long story, and you know it as well as I do, about what is to be gained by beating the enemy back." See, he's addressing their fear there, and then he goes on. "What I would prefer is that you should fix your eyes every day on the greatness of Athens, as she really is, and should fall in love with her. When you realize her greatness, then reflect that what made her great was men with a spirit of adventure, men who knew their duty, men who were ashamed to fall below a certain standard. If they ever failed in an enterprise, they made up their minds that at any rate the city should not find their courage lacking to her, and they gave to her the best contribution they could. They gave their lives. And to all of us, and for their own selves, they won praises that never grow old, the most splendid of memorials, not the memorial in which their bodies are laid, but where their glory remains eternal in men's minds, always there on the right occasion to stir others to speech or action. For famous men have the whole earth as their memorial." End quote. When he is saying, "But where their glory remains eternal in men's minds, always there on the right occasion to stir others to speech or action," that is, again, looking forward to the future and recognizing that we might not necessarily know how we will impact the future, but we will. You could do something today that your 6-year-old grandchild remembers and changes their action 50 years from now. That grandchild might be nobody of importance, or they may be the leaders of one of the most powerful countries in the world. Summed up, this is why history is living and breathing, because of how many unknowns there are. We can look back and see the static written record, and that's true. We can't impact the past, we can't change what's already happened, but we also don't know how it's going to impact us. When the United States was founded, it was Athens that the Founding Fathers looked back at as an example of what not to do with direct democracy. When we can look at their story and start to understand not just the fear, but the excitement, because they did not know what would happen, then we can start seeing history as something living and breathing and pulsing, and know that one day, the things that we are doing right now may have the same impact as well. And that is anything but static. Thanks for listening, folks. I hope you enjoyed my redone for audio-only version of the sound education talk that I gave. It was a really great conference, like I said. Probably do it again this year in November, I think is when they're thinking about. You can check it out at soundeducation.fm to see all the speakers that were there last year. There will be a link if you just scroll down in the description. Again, you can also find the link to the YouTube video of my actual talk that I gave there. So be sure and check both of those out. And then also, while I have you here, quick note on season 2. I'm really sorry it's taken so long to get that started. I won't give you a ton of excuses. I'll just say that I've had to kind of reset and reframe the entire season several times. So I've kind of had to start over a lot, which I did not expect. But I am working on it. I will get something out. I'm going to stop promising dates, but I am working on it and it will come out. In the meantime, thanks again for listening. Thanks for telling others about the show. And I have redone the first several episodes of season 1. So if you want to, you can go back and listen to those to hear the remastered and recorded versions. Anyways, thanks for listening, folks. Hope you're all doing well, and I will talk to you soon.